When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans.
I'll give it a rest. You're under new management. It's Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast now.
Hi, and welcome to Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast. Hooray! We love
hooray.
It. Hooray! Hooray, hooray. And what are we doing today, Gary?
Well, it's a rather sad occasion, Pete. It's the final South Knox Hussar podcast.
Oh,
it's
no.
Germany and the end. This is the end.
Beautiful
friend.
This is the end.
When I say beautiful friend, I just mean the chum.
You mean the listeners, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Thanks for getting me out of that one, Pete. That's very good of you. So.
So where are we?
Where are we?
Well, we've got to the end of the war in Europe, haven't we? And it's crucial to remember that VE Day does not mark the end of the Second World War. It marks the end of the war with Germany. The South Knox Hussars were given responsibility under the military government for the administration of the whole of Coesfeld area in Westphalia, about 55 square miles in total. Can you imagine the responsibility? The regimental headquarters are at a place called Lette. I've no idea where that is. 425 battery, they're at Gescher. The men
are. Do you know where that is?
No. I bet it's near Lette, though. The men are in a school. The mess is large houses. The battery office in a factory. 426. 426. 426.
426.
426 battery. They're geographically scattered, as they say. C trooper in Schloss Romberg in Buldern, D trooper in Dulmen. Most of the men, reasonable comfort. Let's look at what's happening. What's happening in the real world, Gary? This is not the end of the war, is it?
Well, no, as you mentioned, the war with Japan is still ongoing. In fact, it's still raging.
Raging!
Raging, and the British forces were preparing to launch the invasions of Malaya and Singapore, whilst the Americans, they were slogging their way across the island of Okinawa.
So that must seem a world away. Can you imagine how relieved everybody is that they're not dead, the war's over? And,
yeah, they're all going home.
Soon. And then Albert Swinton gets a bolt from the blue. Now, this is Troop Sergeant Major Albert Swinton, someone we followed through these podcasts right from the start. 425 battery, 107th medium. And you're going to say, what sort of a shock did Albert get? I remember
it
your
was a
accent.
Sunday morning. Oh,
wonderful.
I'd got the troop on church parade and I was on the square of this school building. A window opened and it was Major Birkin. He shouts, "Sir, Major, I want to see you now." He says, "There you go." And presented me with a message from the War Office saying that 912-374-02-AH Swinton was posted to the Far East.
How do you feel about that? Anyway, this is BQMS David Tickle of 425 Battery. He was amazed at this, and he said this when he heard the news that Albert had been posted. He says this: We were absolutely staggered when Albert announced they'd been posted to Far East. It was a bit shattering to see a lad like Albert break down and shed a few tears. He said, "Look, I've not done enough. How can they post me out to Far East when I've been through all I've been through? I can't understand it." We were all of the same mind. And the depression that must have hit him, he must have been so pissed off. He decides to fight it, doesn't he? How can you fight the army? I mean, you had a bloody good go, didn't you, in York? And who won?
Well, the army.
Yeah. He leaves the unit in utter despair. And it's like this old thing. He'd been to the well so often, the well of courage, and he felt that not only had he run out of water, but his bucket had a hole in it. Tell me what happens, Albert.
So his troops aren't Major Albert Swinton again. "I saw the colonel, I saw the brigadier. I finished up at Army Group Headquarters. All they said was it's come from the War Office. I couldn't get this thing stopped, so I eventually finished up back at the Royal Artillery Depot, Woolwich. I was very much anti-army at the time because of the way they'd treated me. I was very much a Bolshy type. I lost all interest in what I was doing. I couldn't care less. They could have put me against a wall and shot me as far as I was concerned. I was really annoyed and felt let down. I went home on my embarkation leave for a fortnight. My stepfather said, I'm going to get in touch with my MP. He got it stopped."
And Albert did, in fact, rejoin the unit. But I just thought that was worth including, because for just a shock poor old Albert got. Now, what governs their lives most of all in the first period, you think, Gary? What would you say?
I mean, rather interestingly, at the start of their lives in Germany, there was a strict non-fraternisation rule, which that had been issued by Montgomery back in March 1945. And this was entirely designed to punish all Germans, treating them all equally responsible for the crimes committed by the Nazi regime.
That's not going to work, is it? Well, not with British soldiers. I talked to a lot of veterans, and they always said the thing that stuck in their mind was it was the kids. You can't not talk to a kid. You give them sweets, the rest of it. Although you have to watch it these days, I understand.
Do you want to pause for a moment, Pete? Can I allow you to drown in that?
Just reflect on what I've just said.
Carrying on swiftly.
But the political climate gradually changes, and it's the punishment of all Germans stops being a sort of primary objective. And there's sort of a move to re-education, to creating a new Germany. And you can't really re-educate people if you won't talk to them. And you sort of wonder about. So by September, the British administration has abandoned the idea of non-fraternisation. But there was something really serious, and this is a dark point of this podcast. They're going to try and change one aspect of the character of Nazi Germany. The British government was well aware of the horror of the concentration camps, and they took film footage of Belsen and the other camps when they were liberated. And Sidney Bernstein was commissioned as producer of a propaganda film. And they always say Alfred Hitchcock was involved in editing. I'm not so sure about that. But the idea was to get the maximum emotional impact of scenes that are pretty graphic, really, aren't they? And the film's ultimately shelved, but some of it shown, some of the Belsen footage, was sent to Germany for compulsory viewing by people. And David Elliott, that's 6'6", by this time Captain David Elliott, 425 battery, he says this, I've remembered he was from Surrey, so therefore this voice will reflect my opinion of Surrey people. "The order came down that this film of Belsen concentration camp, which had been taken by the Army Film Unit, was to be shown to all the civilian population over 16 years of age. We had a cinema in the village, and it was fairly straightforward to go along and tell the burgomaster what we wanted. He did protest to start with and said it couldn't be done. And one had to say, of course it could be done. We had an sorry, we had an ex-inmate, got my accents mixed up a bit there. We had an ex-inmate of a concentration camp. I think he was a German Jew, a very, very gaunt fellow. Most of his teeth had been broken. This chap was on the screen talking about what was being shown on the screen. It affected the Germans very deep. No accents here. No, very deeply indeed. As they came out, there was a mixture. The younger women and girls in tears. The men shaking their heads in disbelief. We had a general impression that they didn't realise it had been going on. I don't think they wanted to know. Sorry, I hadn't realised that was coming up. It teaches me to read things ahead, won't it? And also, by the way, Captain David Elliott was a cracking bloke. He's the one who started the South Lots Hussars. He's the one who put the idea forward. A great bloke, great bloke. There's a cynical view that everyone in Germany denied responsibility for anything to do with the Nazi regime once they'd lost the war. I've never made my mind up about this. I don't think that's entirely true, but it's in between the two, isn't it? Albert Swinton had some sympathy for the village. Albert was such a nice bloke. I'm surprised you're playing him and not me.
We had to round up all the civilian population, push them in this room, and you watch this. And we showed this film of Belsen. It was rather horrendous. This was a very rural area, and I don't think a lot of people knew anything about this. I honestly don't. They came out in tears. It really upset them. I wouldn't have thought it possible for any human being to treat another human being like it.
I see you went for the accent anyway.
Well, I just thought I've been doing it. I can't stop doing it.
Oh, yeah. So this was one thing going on. Now, there's something else going on, and that is as they were in charge, they were responsible for the administration control of the displaced persons and various POW camps. In all seven camps, varied nationalities, there's a problem. What do you think one of the biggest problems of running a displaced persons camp is?
Well, no one spoke the languages, I would imagine.
And everybody in the camps has had hell on earth. And if you've just been treated so badly for years, you've been treated in a manner that is barely human, do you think you're in a mood to compromise?
No.
So there is a problem with these displaced persons, which is a tragic problem for every angle. And you're going to be Captain Bob Folds, another great friend that we've been following throughout these podcasts. How many were there? There's been about 10 of them. There's more. I don't know. We don't know how many more. Lots of South Lots of South. And this is Captain Bob Folds about the camps.
D Troop had one camp, Russians and Slavs in this camp. There must have been about 300 of them in a wired-off section of houses alongside the railway track in Dulman. They were a very unlikable lot. We never had any sort of rapport with them, unfortunately. They were very primitive types, big, stolid people who stood round you and just looked blankly at you whenever you went in the compound. And they weren't easy to deal with. They had terrible grudges against the Germans, and they used to go out at night raiding German farms for food, women, and anything else. We finished up in the stupid, ironic position of trying to protect the Germans against the displaced persons. It was sad, but that was how it worked out.
And it is sad. And some of those symptoms, just looking blankly, they're symptoms of PTSD, they're symptoms of shock. These people have been treated beyond belief. And sadly, if you treat people badly, they respond badly. They assigned a corporal, sergeant, few soldiers to each camp, but they couldn't stop them breaking out, and they exacted a terrible, terrible revenge. And this is Harold Harper, Battery Sergeant Major Harold Harper, 426 Battery. Every night we were called out by the local population because the Russians, that's the displaced person Russians, were going round looting and raping and God knows what. We saw some terrible instances of rape. I once had the job of taking a young girl who'd been raped to hospital. I never found out if she lived or not, but she was in a terrible state. Then we went into this barn and there was this young girl lying there. The grandparents in the corner had obviously gone to her protection and they'd been shot. This is terrible. This is the horrible bit of war that sometimes people don't realise it's going on. As the months go on, they find themselves... It's ironic, but the South Lots Hussars find themselves... They'd fought so hard against fascism. They find themselves, and this is all unknowing, complicit in what is now considered a war crime as they obeyed orders. And I'm not saying that the South Africa Hussars are war criminals. I'm saying that what they were ordered to do has now been perceived as a war crime. They didn't mean it, and Bob Folds explains what happened. And I want you to think about the complications of all this. You're going to be Bob Folds, aren't you, Gary?
Captain Bob Folds, 426 Battery. Eventually, towards the end of the summer, orders came through that they were going to be repatriated. In our innocence, we thought, well, they'll enjoy going home. We got them into lorries with not a great deal of trouble and started off going east towards the Russian zone. Then we couldn't understand why they kept on jumping off the lorries. We had to stop and fix bayonets, get them back on again. We got them to the frontier with a great deal of difficulty. They were terribly apprehensive about going home, which was something we didn't understand because we knew nothing of the Russian internal setup at that time. We began to understand later on that forced repatriation was a terribly cruel and unkind thing. In our innocence, it hadn't occurred to us that we'd sent all these Russians back to a very uncertain future, to put it mildly.
I think that explains what happened well. I'm not completely exonerating, but what I mean is it's one of those terrible things. When he says, to put it mildly, most of them were killed. They were shot as collaborators by the Soviets. Not a good thing. Let's move on. Slowly, the situation normalises. It's amazing how quickly things settle down. And the soldiers are beginning to make real attempts to make friendly contacts with the Germans. And one point is, it's like children. It's a mutual interested sport. It sort of brings people together. And this is Battery Sergeant Major Harold Harper, 426 Battery. He says, after we can go back to daft accents, after fraternisation ban was off, we decided to try and get on with the local population. We organised this football match. What we didn't realise was that this team was playing in the second division at German League. They'd raked in one or two 40-year-olds who'd been ex-professionals, and they'd labelled it Stadtholm versus the British Army. And all it was against our battery. We lost 7-0. The only bloke that came out of it with any sort of credit in our crowd was the poor old goalkeeper, who let 7 in, but nevertheless made about 20 marvellous saves. And again, this reminds us of our own football teams, in particular my football team at the moment, who can't seem to score.
The lovely Liverpool, doing well.
They're doing really well.
How'd they get on last night?
They lost.
Oh.
Anyway, so the Germans also watch on as the soldiers try and introduce them to cricket. Now, I've often a sort of primitive person won't understand cricket. You can see.
Or me.
As I said, a primitive person won't understand. A primitive, stupid, non-intellectual, sort of plebeian force for evil won't understand.
Or me.
Or Gary. Anyway, this is Battery Sergeant Major Harold Harper describing their attempts to bring cricket to the natives. He says, I bowled first over. My friend were batting. I'm no bowler. I just took two paces, brought my arm over, and the ball reared up and hit him on the head. Off two paces! I thought it must have been a freak. Next one, hit him on the shoulder, so we decided to pack it in. The wicket weren't good enough. The funny thing about it was the whole German village had turned out to see this freak match, and they thought it was rather funny to see British shoulders knocking hell out of each other. I bet they did. what's important? What happens to British soldiers if you don't amuse them, Gary?
Well, if they get bored, they get into trouble. So they introduce regular ENSA shows. Cinemas were set up running British films. And there were regular football matches organised into leagues with neighbouring units. And that went, I was in Germany in the early 80s and that was continuing.
Now, the one thing, some of you might remember Ken Giles, our resident intellectual, who was a genius, and he was occupied as in a secret capacity as the narc. No, meaning writing a scandalous gossip column for the new regimental magazine, which was called, unimaginatively, The Acorn. And he said this. Oh, it was called The Oak Leaves. I really must read things before I start.
I'm going to read this one, Pete.
Oh, go on then.
You mentioned all my attributes there.
Yes.
So this is Lance Sergeant Ken Giles, 425 Battery. Regimental headquarters started the Royal Newspaper, which they called the Oak Leaves. A German printing firm
It was from London.
I know that. A German printing firm was engaged, and the production was quite professional. I confess now for the first time in my life that I wrote weekly
the
column.
The only bloody accent that you could get right. You can't
under the pseudonym of the Narc. I tried my best to dig up any scandal about anybody, in a nice way, of course, printing little anecdotes of various members of the battery. On one occasion, Captain Elliot went on a trip into the Moselle looking for wine for the officers' mess. I turned it into a kind of almost criminal-like journey and christened him Papa Leliot. I think these things were taken in good part, sometimes a little bit peaked, perhaps. Where did you hear of this? Perhaps my style of writing gave me away. Most people said, are you the narc? I always denied it.
And he continued to deny it until the interview. He was
until he moved to Nottingham and got a Nottingham
he
accent.
He didn't move to Nottingham. He was living in somewhere near Eastbourne when I interviewed him. Anyway, black market. Black market. We've talked about black market before. It's normally on a small scale, but it's not a pretty business, is it? I don't know. I've never liked black marketeers. It's not funny. It's not spivs. They'd exchange their ration to German civilians, gaining disproportionate volumes,
value
goods and things. So watches, jewellery, silverware, clocks, various heirlooms.
Well, some of them traded for sexual favours as well, Pete. Let's be honest about this.
And that's capitalised on desperation, isn't it? You don't get a lot of that in oral history. And I'm not saying that the South Tsars did a lot of this kind of thing. I'm just saying it did happen. Others formed genuine, if you like, relationships with German women, although I always wonder why why the women were so keen for a relationship. But at least it offers an escape, doesn't it?
It does.
The end comes. It's all a bit of an anticlimax. When I was writing my book, At Close Range, which is now available in all good internet, because there's always an anticlimax in any unit history, because in the end it all comes to an end. They all go back to civilian life, men are posted away gradually to other units. They're posted back home, and best of all, of course, they're demobbed. And this is Battery Sergeant Major Harold Harper. The first chap to be demobbed, we had a party, and it turned out disastrous. We were drinking German schnapps. That's terrible stuff. It wasn't matured. We were getting it from local still. We had at the foot of the stairs, go at the foot of the stairs, I love that expression, a marble statue of a girl, and a couple of sergeants decided they'd put this statue in commanding officer's bed. It was only about 2 foot high. But when they tried to take it off the pedestal, then they realised how heavy it was, and it crashed down. The chap who was about to be demobilised, he was underneath. He broke all his teeth, and his demob got pulled back 6 weeks. Oh, that reminds me of someone called Gary Bain and his friend Mark Jackson. They were the similar sort of complete spanners. How are they demobilised, Gary?
Well, they'd learned from the Great War when things had not gone particularly well, so they were demobilised in age groups, which that pretty much reflected how they'd volunteered or been called up. So it was a conscious effort to avoid the unfairness that happened after the Great War.
Did it succeed, do you reckon?
Largely, yeah. I mean, there would be exceptions, but I think it did. And Troop Sergeant Major Albert Swinton says, the various groups went off in numbers. We'd lost two blokes on this group and four blokes on that group. If any of my blokes were going away, I always made a point of grabbing a couple of bottles out of the sergeant's mess and going down to the men's billets, get the blokes who were being demobbed and their particular friends, and we'd all sit down and have a drink. It got a bit hectic, I must say. I have no idea where that accent was from.
Most of the original, you know, the people that we had in our very first episode when they were mobilised, they're almost all back home by the time the regimental adjutant. Now, that's Captain Ian Sinclair, who was just a sergeant. Well, he was a gunner at the start, then a sergeant. He gets the notes of the official disbandment of the South Hudson Hussars on 28th of February 1946. The few who are still serving are dispersed around all the artillery regiments all round in Germany. The South Hudson Hussars were no more. Now, home. What does that mean? What did it mean? What does it mean, Gary?
It means the place you live, Pete.
I think it means everything. I think it means the hopes, the dreams. There's an emotional investment of six long, painful years of fixating, idealising it, isn't it? Can you imagine?
And it means the place where you live, Pete.
Bursting shells, hissing bullets, rolling tanks. Those are all things.
When they got home.
When they met their wife. 6 years of physical punishment, terrible wounds, the aches, the injuries, the pain, the hunger, the endless thirst. This is beginning to sound more and more like home. The mortifying humiliations, the dysentery, the pustulating sores.
I think they actually mean the war.
The piles, the scabies, the fleas. This is Gary's home life. Made flesh.
Yeah, don't forget, for some, this is liberty following years as prisoners of war.
Oh, you mean the ones who were captured at night?
Yeah, it's not just those that came home from Germany, those that were captured.
So it's 6 years, you've seen people you know, your friends killed, you could have been killed at any moment. 6 years of being separated from your families. And remember, there's bombing going on in London, in Nottingham, in not a lot in Nottingham, but there's still bombing. There might be that their families would be killed while they were away. And then at last it's all over. Would there be a big civic reception like after the Iraq War or Falklands?
No, because they came back in dribs and drabs. As we mentioned, they were released in age groups, so there was no mass return, so there was no opportunity for a big civic reception.
So all a bit of an anticlimax again, isn't it? There's no common response to war, I don't think, but there's no common response to getting back to civilian life. I think, do you think people took seriously politicians' promises?
Well, yes. No, I mean, politicians then as now were over-promising. They realised, the men realised whatever the promises were. There were far too many people returning from the armed services to allow any special care to be taken of them. They get their old jobs back, though. That was something that the new Labour government was prioritising, as well as house building.
But was the economy in good shape? No.
No, the country was in effect bankrupt, wasn't it?
So no homes fit for heroes, or not for a while. No brave new world, eh? No brave new world. They're also losing something. Now, you were in the army. What did you most miss when you left the army? And you hadn't been to war.
Custard. I missed the cookhouse custard. That and comradeship. You miss your mates.
You miss your mates. That's it. And they'd fought alongside them. They'd got an incredible bond. I'm not sure. I mean, for you, you probably could recreate. But for others, I mean, you've got that bond of comradeship you formed with me, Gary.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's part of the problem. It's a special bond, and it probably was never fully understood by the civilians.
No. And this is Harold Harper. He's now a civilian. And he said, one always thought the day you got demobbed was going to be fantastic. fantastic. You jumped for joy as I left all the chaps behind who I'd been with. Some, for many years, there was a touch of sadness. Some, one felt quite cut off from something that had been part of your life. And there's another thing about it. How had they gone off to war?
Well, they were boys, weren't they? A lot of them. They were very, very young, and now they're back as men.
Yeah, because 6 years, I mean, I'm in my 60s. 6 years, I'd still be in my 60s. I'm getting old, Gary. But it passes in a blink of the eye, doesn't it? Years now, a year is nothing. 6 years is now. But when you're 20 to 26, it's your life, isn't it? I mean, just a year is everything. You're 18 to 19, you're 19 to 20. That's a long, long time. And you can never really get it back. And you're going to be George Pearson, who'd been with the South Hussars. He's in the early episodes. He was a great character. But then he left to become an officer after Tobruk. You're going to be him. So tell us what George Pearson says, Gary.
I went to war at 20 years of age and came back at 25. Those of us that had been NCOs and then officers, there had never been a time within those 5 or 6 years where you'd not got responsibilities to other people, looking after other people. What should have been your youthful years of most fun, your early 20s, they'd been passed and you'd always had responsibilities. I won't say you didn't enjoy yourself. You did, of course. But your most youthful years had been taken away from you.
And they've also changed as men, haven't they? So you send off a polite young boy from, and he's been exposed to not only the dreadful things of war, but the dreadful things of military life, just the crudities. They'd lost some of their best friends in a split second, just gone. Just 1 minute they're there, then and they've not really had a chance to grieve. And you're going to be Jack Sykes now, aren't you? And what does he say?
I'd had a fairly sheltered sort of life before I went into the army. I'd lived with my grandma, pretty spoilt, never drank, smoked. I went out with young ladies. I learnt a few facts of life while I was in the army, and that hardened me up, made me much more self-confident, and taught me how to get on with people.
And I think a point about people, it's noticeable, for instance, in this COVID epidemic, it's hitting the young heart in some, not illness-wise, but they're losing a year of their life from 18 to 19. My daughters are really suffering from losing all that time of going to the pub and running around in circles that we enjoyed, Gary. And for us, we're just old buggers. We'd hardly be out more than once or twice a week anyway. Anyway, now they're just ordinary civilians, all these men. All these men have been to war. And do you think they're special?
No, no, I mean, you've got to remember that the people on the home front had suffered their own privations as well. You know, they'd risked death from bombs and later in the war from the V weapons. They'd worked long shifts in the coal mines or munitions factories. They'd had to live on restricted rations. So many of them didn't have the empathy to understand the extra mile, if you like, that the soldiers had gone when they were at the front.
And I think that's really true. So soldiers, there's millions of them for a start, but then there's millions of civilians who've suffered and have gone through hell. Now, Ted Whittaker, let's do some examples here. Sorry, I just banged the microphone. Ted Whittaker, he's demobilised and he comes back after being a POW. Now, you remember Ted, he was captured at Knightsbridge. So he'd had another 3 years, 4 years, I can't work it out, as a POW, and he went to see about getting his old job back as a clerk at a light engineering factory. And this is appalling what happens to Ted. He was a lovely man. He said this. He's from Leicester, or he was when I interviewed him, so I'm just going to speak to it. I'm not going to use an accent. I was not exactly made welcome. The chap who'd taken charge came to see me. The first thing he said was, "Can't spare long. We're ever so busy. You've no idea what it's been like while you've been away." I thought, this is really promising. A friend of mine rang me up and said, "This job they put you on, they're just going to give you it. It's the minimum they're required to do. It's sorted out stuff we've got in stock from government contracts. And when that's finished, you're finished. I think they had to take you on for a year." Meaning they had no intention of honouring the pledge for getting your job back for good. In the end, Whittaker doesn't pursue that. He goes to a government-sponsored business studies course and ends up pursuing a career as a clerk with Nottingham City Treasurer's Department. So he gets a proper job. He lived in Leicester when I interviewed him. He was a cracking bloke. Do you think your achievements in the army, say if you'd been a gunner and you'd risen to be a troop sergeant major, do you think that matters when you go back home, Gary?
No, it's irrelevant. And in the case of Albert Swinton, he returned to his old job at the Players Cigarette Factory. And he says, "No bother, no bother at all. As far as I was concerned, the war was finished and I was civilian. And the fact that I'd been a sergeant major didn't count for anything. Our warrant officer, Danny Lamb, he worked at Players. He was only on a machine, same as me. My machine was at the end of the row, nearest the window. I used to stand there with these two windows open and my head stuck out. The number of times the foreman came along and caught me was nobody's business. Having spent the last 6 years living in a hole in the ground, and to then get stuck in an air-conditioned factory, it didn't go down very well."
Now, he was a great bloke. He stuck it out for about a year, then he just looked for something that gave him an outdoor life. He was ruined for indoor work, if you like. He was married with a family, so he couldn't rejoin the army. This is something that constantly comes back. The irregular army isn't a job for a married man, if you've already been away for 6 years as well. So instead he became a policeman, and and he had a good career in the police. One of our favourites. Who's the person who most... One of the people who most stuck out for you in these podcasts?
Well, I don't think it's just me. I mean, from the feedback we've been getting, Ray Ellis is very popular. He speaks well. Some of his quotes are very funny, in fact. And before the war, he didn't have any sort of settled job. He'd been working as a junior clerk, a training engineer, and a furniture salesman. So when he comes back from a return from a German POW camp...
So he was taken at Knightsbridge as well, so that's...
Yeah. It initially looks like he sort of fall apart. He'd become very bitter and disillusioned. And he went absent without leave from the army.
Did you ever However, do that?
I'm taking a fifth. However, he got over the worst of his depression and he began to look for something worthwhile to do with his life. And eventually he trained under the government scheme, the emergency teacher training scheme, became a teacher.
Now, that's two people have been helped by government schemes. So the government isn't an insensitive brute force. It's trying. It's just the scale of the problem. Individuals get caught in the cracks, don't they? Anyway, how does Ray react to teacher training?
"I was overjoyed. I really was thrilled to think that now, instead of spending my life killing, I was going to be able to do some good with things I loved, children. I really did. It wasn't a phony thing. It wasn't silly. I was a very serious-minded person, and I really was sincere about wanting to do good and be good to children. I got through the hatred and was coming through to a more positive way of thought and thinking of what I could do. I became a teacher."
He really does well at that, and he becomes a really popular headmaster, which is a rare thing. He was a Nottingham lad, but by the time I interviewed him, he was in Lincoln. He lived right at the top of that hill. You know the big hill in Lincoln? Oh, sorry. Right at the top of there he was, and he was one of the very few that I actually went for a drink with in the evening. He was such a great bloke, and just to talk with it seems amazing to have that chance to talk to someone as amazing as him. Do you think war veterans, how do you think they feel about other people who hadn't gone to war?
It's difficult for them not to look down on people that hadn't gone through the experience.
Even if they'd had genuine reasons? I mean, well, some people are physically incapable or they're in reserved occupations, aren't they?
Yeah, but they just looked... It's difficult, Pete. They've not experienced what those men had experienced, and it's very difficult for them not to consider that. And they'd lost 6 years of their life, you know.
Well, what does that mean in practice, then?
Well, people that had stayed behind had got on, you know, so they hadn't stood still in their careers, for example, and sometimes this led to conflicted emotions. And there's a quote from Charles Ward, which I'm going to read, and he says... "The beneficial effect was that when you came back, It sounds smug, but you could hold your head high. People, particularly accountants who had managed to stay at home, it sounds a bit childish now, but you did feel you'd done your bit. You were resentful that you'd lost 6 years against people who were competing with you, and you'd got to catch up 6 years, which is quite a long time in an accountant's life.
It's the whole training period, and it's a long, long time. Now, we said earlier, there's lots of different ways of reacting to coming out of the forces. And this is Dennis Middleton. Now, he was a real character, a humorist, if you like. And he said this: mentally, I gained a great deal in self-confidence. I'd acquired the philosophy not to bother about what everybody else thinks. You know that expression, you can't do that, or you can't wear that, or what will people think? I couldn't care less what people will think. And that was that's a positive. He was a positive chap, and he came through it, and he felt he'd overcome it. He gained from the war, if you like, his war experiences. But there's something that lurks, something else that lurks for a lot of people. What's that, Gary?
Yeah, I mean, it's what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder, although you certainly would, and I know others, would argue that the disorder was an entirely natural reaction to the stresses that they'd had to endure.
Yeah, I remember Ali saying that, and it struck he said, this is just, it's not a disorder. it's absolutely natural. And the example we're going to use here is a chap called Harry Day. And a lot of them had coped well in the fighting. They coped well as POWs. But they had terrible problems when they got home. And Harry Day explained he'd been the medical order. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember.
Remember he had the bloke, he was on his knee, and the bloke had his head shot off?
Yeah.
Not nice. Well, what does Harry say?
It was like taking a splint off a fracture. While the splint was on, while you were in stations of stress and fear, you were all right. You could combat it because you'd become used to combating it. When you got home, the splint fell off. I could not go into a public house on my own. A train letting off steam was like a bomb, and I would drop to the ground in those early days. For years, that is how we kept ourselves alive. It wore off altogether. It took about a year. My local doctor said, as much sport as you can manage. That was great. I loved sport.
And, he did get better. Now, Ted Holmes, he reckoned he got more and more nervous as the war went on. He just found the stress building up, and everything he survived seemed to build up the mental pressure. It carried on into his civilian life, and Ted became a grave digger at Haslam Church, and I visited that grave. His house was just along from it. He was one of my favourites, but I'm going to do him in a Chesterfield accent because I can, because I'm from Chesterfield myself, or Luton.
Or Luton.
Or Stanhope, or Liverpool, or East Finchley, one of them. I think you got more nervous. It was what I used to call bomb happy. If you heard an aeroplane coming, you were looking round. And sometimes if there was a noise sounding like a bomb, you'd drop on the floor. Even today, after all these years, if a low-flying plane comes over, I'm nearly flat down on the floor. I can't help it. It's just a reaction. And that I interviewed him in the late 80s or early 90s. That makes you think, doesn't it? It's really ingrained. Because if you didn't get flat on the floor, you'd be dead. And it's an ingrained wartime reaction, and you can't suppress it afterwards. And you're going to be Ernie Hurry now. He lived in Nottingham, a great blog. What does he say?
I still suffer from bad nerves. I was always listening for things happening. I'd had that all the way through. Any movements, wherever I went, approaching a house or anywhere, I'd be always listening and ready to jump at the first sign of anything. It never leaves you. You've still got that intuition. Any sound, you jump. Sometimes I'd be working and some of the people, they'd drop something behind me for a joke. I'd jump a mile, startled, and they'd think it was funny. I still have it today. It's a thing I live with.
And you know damn well, Gary, that if you'd been working with that bloke, you'd have dropped something behind him. Because that's what humour is. It's cruel at times. And I feel so sorry for Ernie Harry, and But I don't blame the blacks dropping things behind them, because that's just what human nature's like. It's not a weakness, is it, Gary? It's not a weakness. Harold Harper's been with us all the way through these podcasts. How would you describe Harold Harper as a soldier? I would say he was the obverse of you.
He was a superb, competent soldier. His job, did it well.
And what happens when the pressure's released? Well, I'm going to read this quote from Harold. I'm not going to use an accent because I find this quite sad. I was a type of soldier that went in to do a job, and having done the job, was quite happy to get back to civilian life. I went back to Boots Accounting Department. I went in as a boy and I came out as very much a man. I was very worn out. The stress of getting back into civilian life, because you realise how much you'd lost when you pitted yourselves against the blokes at work who hadn't left the company. They knew everything that was going off and you didn't. There was a sign of Chesterfield accent going off. Ah, what's going off? The reaction set in after I got home. You tensed yourself up during the war, and now you weren't so tense. The thing was backfiring on you. I didn't have a nervous breakdown, but I was close to it. I was scared to cross the road. This is Harold Harper, scared to cross the road. Scared to sit on the top of a double-decker bus. I want to point out, this is Harold Harper, Battery Sergeant Major. That started about a year after I was demobbed. My father was very blunt, and he told me, in no uncertain manner, what to do. And this is not advice for those suffering from depression or mental problems. But it worked for Harold. Pull yourself together! When the Territorial Army reformed in 1947, I had a fair amount of persuasion to join, but I wouldn't. I just didn't feel as though I wanted to get involved again. I suppose war weariness and the nerve had gone a little bit. Brave man, brave enough to admit that he wasn't up to it anymore. That he'd been to the well once too often. It was running dry, you know. The next one is Frank Penlington. Now, Frank was an unusual character. He was Welsh. So I've got to try, haven't I? And indirectly, this sums up. When a man comes back from the war, is it only him, Gary, that suffers?
No, his wife and children will,
his family,
have to cope with it as well, yeah.
And this is what Frank said. The war wasn't a reality, was it? After the war, you come out to reality. And I've never accepted that. Although I say it myself, I've never been normal since I... Oh, God, I've never been normal since I left the army. And my wife will tell you.
Yeah, apart from the accent, that could have been you talking about you there, really, couldn't
you,
it?
You mean the bit about Polly telling me I'm not
Polly
normal?
Polly would definitely tell you you're not normal, yeah.
Yeah, well, I beg to differ. Now, we're getting more and more serious in the sense of approach, Ian. There's something else. It's not only mental problems that people have. It's not a problem, it's mental, just the effects. There's physical. Some of them have been badly wounded and they have to put up with this. Now, the next one's going to be Bobby Feakins. You remember Bobby? He's the one who was in the armoured car when Jerry Birkin had a shell go right through his stomach. He's the one who had injured legs from that. And he's the one who had the heads and corpses of the headless signallers in the back of the car, armoured car with him. And he still suffered from the physical effects when I interviewed him 50 years later. Now, this chap's from London, so I'm expecting a good London accent from you, but not too silly. Sometimes you get better from an army disability, don't you? But what happens when you get old? It comes back, doesn't it?
It does.
And by the time
By
the time he was in his 80s, when I saw him, he could hardly walk. Anyway, you tell us what he says.
Bobby Feakins. I received a disability pension of 20% for my legs. I still limped, and in those days, somebody that limped was known as gimpy. I was determined to get rid of the limp. I struggled and struggled, and the pain was pretty bad, but I eventually did. It took me 18 months to get rid of the limp. I hadn't got a job to go to, no counselling or training whatsoever. I was no different from anybody else. We were all returning from overseas, the jobs having been done by young women in our absence that had to be scaled down to allow those coming home to take jobs. We gradually got back on our feet. I'd always been very interested in motor cars, and I got a job with a second-hand car company. I'd become of a nervous disposition, and I always felt that I was unequal to an awful lot of people. That has never left me. I always feel that I should have done an awful lot more with my life.
And that a life, not so much ruined, but a sense of lost potential, he was a wonderful old boy. He lived in Harrow when I interviewed him, and a fantastic bloke. Do you think our country did enough for the veterans and their families in the years after the war? Do you think they tried?
I think they tried, but I think it's you know, the men themselves have made the point about the millions of people that were returning to the country from war service, and arguably it was impossible for them to do what they were trying to do, but they did need to do a little more. People, I mean, that's a very, very sad situation that Bobby Feakins found himself in, where he wasn't getting any support. He was invalided out of the army. You know, he had terrible wounds, and the fact that he saw himself as unequal to others, I mean, it's terrible, terrible that he put himself in a situation. And you could have helped with men like him.
I expect that our country looks after its veterans, a much less number of veterans from Iraq and the Falklands. Gary, is that the case, do you think?
I'm not qualified to comment on that, Pete. The people that I know say otherwise.
Yeah, and I think so as well. But it's a country's duty to look after its serving veterans after they've served. Now, many of the men I interviewed, they told me that before I went to see them, and I want you to picture a half-wit turning up at somebody's house. I expect you are picturing that. They told me that in the nights before recording and sessions and afterwards, they had terrible nightmares.
What about you?
No, about their war service, Gary. Oh. It awakened the demons. Do you know that one last act of courage? They were still willing to record their memories. Why do you think they wanted to record their memories? Why?
Well, I think they wanted to leave something for others, so that they leave something for posterity, for want of a better word, so that people learn from their experiences.
What it was
and
like.
And also to just share that, you know, it's not just the experiences of the war, but to try and share their feelings of comradeship even, and the friends that they made and the respect that they held people in. That all comes across in the interviews. It's not just the horror of the war.
And most of all, I think, to remember and pay tribute to the friends that died too soon. And at the time, they might have thought, oh, well, we're all going to get killed soon. But then when you've lived another 70 years, you think, or 60 or 70 years, you think, oh, poor old John or Jack, dead in 1940, 42, and here's me in 2000 and whatever. They must feel terrible. And those friends are left buried in a far... It's the thing, it's some far off fields. Now that most of the South Lots Hussars I interviewed are dead, if not all of them, I think they all are, and this isn't a joke, I'd just like to pay a personal homage to them, to say thank you. For all they did. They were ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And you're going to read the last quote, and we won't bother with the accent, I think, just to give us a feel. This is Reg Cutter from Newcastle, and it's the last words for this podcast until we say bye-bye, of course.
We all got on very well. We were all just brothers in arms, the whole lot of us.
Just brothers in arms. I think that's wonderful. And thank you, Gary, for being with me during this journey. Can't stay serious.
Yeah, I'd like to...
I can't stay serious for long.
I'd like to thank you for introducing me to the men of the South Notts Hussars. You know, as you know, my interest is not in the Second World War. So I'd like to thank you for that. And I think others would like to thank you as well. I think that along the journey, we've come to know people like Ray Ellis particularly well.
Albert Swinton,
Frank Pennington even. You know, these are names that are now meaning something to us that perhaps they didn't before. So thank you, Pete. And I will, at the end of this, say that if you've enjoyed these podcasts, as I have, then you should get out there and purchase At Close Range, because it is a fantastic book, and it's a testament to these men.
Thank you, Gary. You're my new favourite. And thank you most of all to the South Lutz Hussars. Cheers.
Cheers, Pete.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?